Beyond Flashpoints, we spend the entire hour with author and environmental philosopher Derek Jensen, who talks about the collapse of industrial capitalism and peak oil economy, and what it will take for people to resist the destructive urges of civilization and replace it with a culture of resistance. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. The Night Report is off tonight. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As deadly hurricanes, exploding cancer and asthma epidemics, endangered and decimated animal and plant species, global hunger and poverty, wars and occupations grab the news headlines each day, many people would not thread them together, and the question of why this is happening does not get asked by the collective populace, nor answered by those few in so-called power. In his riveting and uncompromising two-volume book, Endgame, award-winning author and environmental philosopher Derek Jensen carefully examines the global ecological catastrophe from the ground up, implicating not only the egregious corporations that leech off the earth and in turn toxify it, but our own lack of resistance to the system in general that keeps this paradigm of destruction in place and well-fed. Derek Jensen is one of the boldest voices in our country, speaking out against the toxic system that is rapidly destroying the planet and changing the lives of all humans and non-humans alike. Jensen unflinchingly confronts the most urgent issues of our times: climate change, the end of the oil economy, and the decimation of essential biodiversity, with his renowned lucid, stirring prose that has been described as both breaking and mending the reader's heart. He is the recipient of many awards, including the 2008 Hoffler Award and the 2006 Press Action Person of the Year Award. I was privileged to be invited to spend some time with Derek Jensen, along with Flashpoint special correspondent and independent journalist Dar Jamail, last month at Jensen's home in Northern California. Today on Flashpoints, we present part one of a two-part interview with Derek Jensen as he describes the state of emergency that this planet is facing, as corporations, capitalism, and Western culture's urge to destroy life and suppress freedom for all its beings brings this planet to the breaking point of sustainability and viability. I began by asking Jensen to describe and define where and who we are as a culture, what's happening to our land bases, and how we got to this point.
We're living in the end game of civilization. We are living in the midst of the apocalypse. You know, people might go, oh my gosh, that sounds so extreme, but 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans. That would be the equivalent in temperate forests of there being 90 feet thick of styrofoam everywhere. There were once runs of salmon so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they would capsize. There were, in the eastern United States, flocks of passenger pigeons so large that they darkened the sky for days at a time. There were 6 times as many passenger pigeons as all other birds in North America combined. There were flocks of Eskimo curlews that were so thick that if you close your eyes and point a gun up in the air and shoot, you'd kill 10, 15, 20 birds, and they were so fat that they would explode when they hit the ground. And they're all gone. Do you know why there aren't any penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There used to be, but they were exterminated. They were called great auks. And there were so many that one of the French explorers said that on just one island that you could load every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. Well, they did, and it did. And the last great auk was killed in the 19th century. This culture has been destroying every land base everywhere for the last several thousand years. I mean, this culture began in Iraq and in what is now Iraq. And when you think of Iraq as the first thing that you think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's what Iraq was, or what is now Iraq. And the first written myth of this culture, one of the first written myths of this culture, is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make great cities. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. You know, we've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon, and they still have one on their flag, you know. Greece was heavily forested. There were lions in Greece. And it was one of those dead Greek guys, I don't remember who, Aristotle or Plato or somebody, was complaining that deforestation was harming water quality. And I'm reasonably certain that those, whatever the equivalent of the Greek EPA at the time, told him that they need to study it for a few years to make sure there's a connection. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests went down for the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. This culture is killing the planet, and we walk through our days as though it's all a big video game, and we can stop and go back to the last time we saved, and this time do it right. And that's not a possibility. This is real life we're talking about. You know, Dick Cheney says that the American way of life is not negotiable. Well, I have news for him. Real life is not negotiable. There's this fundamental inversion of reality that people somehow think that the real world is industrial capitalism. Well, the real world is the real world. I want to tell you a quick story about a terrible interview I did. It was this guy down in Santa Barbara. He's a right-wing, anti-environmental, property rights uber all his Bible thumper who evidently wanted to yell at an environmentalist. So he had me on a show and by phone. And it was pretty stunning because I kept talking about the things I'm mentioning here, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, salmon getting hammered, all this stuff. And he kept saying, you know, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. I was really confused because I thought I was talking about the real world. And then I realized that for him, the real world is industrial capitalism. And that's actually how a lot of people use it. When you talk to college kids, they'll say to each other, so what are you going to do when you get in the real world? And what they really mean is, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? But that's not the real world. I mean, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. So there's this fundamental inversion of reality that so many people perceive and have been taught to perceive, that the real world is industrial capitalism. The real world is not forests, is not soil, is not clean water. Well, I got news for everybody. The people who come after, presuming that people do come after at this point, the people who come after are not going to care about what economic system we currently have. They're not going to care about whether we do really great radio programs or we write really great books. They're not going to care about whether we were pacifists or not pacifists. They're not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care about whether we were spiritually pure. They're not going to care about whether we meditated. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. That's the bottom line. And as things are going, they won't be able to. You can't have a linear culture, a progressive culture, on a finite planet. I mean, I was saying earlier that the culture has been destroying its land base for several thousand years. That's always because there was one more river to dam. There was always one more hill you could go over and deforest on the other side. There was one more lake you could defish. And it's not true. It was never a viable option. And at this point, it's certainly not a viable option. I don't remember who it is who said this, but somebody said that anyone who believes you can have infinite growth on a finite planet is either a madman or an economist. And that's really true, and that's where we are. On one level, we are living at the end of the world. And on another level, it's a really great time to be alive because the system is so monolithic and so dependent upon one source of energy that it is very vulnerable. And it is more vulnerable, I think, than it has ever been. And it is our responsibility and our duty and our joy to bring down this culture before it kills everything there is. So that's where we are.
You say that we're vulnerable, but it looks like, you know, if you just take a look outside, you see the massive skyscrapers. You see the military-industrial complex at its, you know, most powerful that it's probably ever been in the history of, you know, the so-called, you know, civilized world. You see multiple wars taking place, all to feed this system. I mean, from all aspects, from all perspectives, it looks like it can't possibly be vulnerable. So how is it vulnerable?
It takes 10 calories of prehistoric energy, oil and natural gas, to make 1 calorie of food. The food that we eat is not produced locally. Produced, what a wonderful word. The food that we eat is not grown or harvested locally. It travels great distances. And I look around, and that right there is a tremendous vulnerability. And I look around, well, also, why are there so many wars? One of the reasons that there are so many wars is because of the necessity of because of the dependence of this economic system on that oil. And that right there creates any number of vulnerabilities. When I look around, I see one of the reasons that those in power don't have to worry about the vulnerabilities is because we in this country are so fully pacified and so fully metabolized into the system that we don't resist. And for the most part, we don't even think about resisting. And when we do actually resist, it's usually in ways that are almost entirely and probably intentionally ineffective. And one of my heroes is Tecumseh. There are many things I love about him. One of them is that he was willing to fight and kill and die and live for the land where his people lived. And one of the advantages that he had over us, well, to one of the things that I really like about him is he would say things like, war upon the living, war upon the dead. We should throw their bones into the ocean. And it's great because after reading somebody like him, then me talking about fighting back seems a little bit less radical than, you know, when we compare me to people who want to do candlelight vigils and sign petitions. But one of the advantages that he had over us is I remember in one of his speeches, he was talking about how he was exhorting people to fight back against the dominant culture and saying, look at these trees that you slept under as a baby and you played under as a child and you've sported under as a youth, whatever sported means, and that you rest after you hunt. These trees will be cut down to make fences. And an advantage that he had was that his people lived in healthy forests. And I was not raised under trees. And I have not ever had a long-term relationship with a healthy forest. And really, frankly, at this point, nobody living has, because there is no such thing as a healthy forest anymore. It's much easier to fight for something you have and is being taken from you than to fight for something you've never known. And it's much easier to get free people to fight for their freedom than it is to get slaves to fight for freedom they've never known. Whether we recognize it or not, we are slaves to this system. I mean, have you ever thought about the phrase, thank God it's Friday? What a horrible, horrible, insane phrase. Thank God that another week of my so short life is gone. We don't question working at jobs that we don't love. I used to have this habit of asking people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? It's absolutely insane. That's not merely just a drag. That's really very political. A few years ago, or when I was writing my book, Culture Make Believe, I read this extraordinary book that was a collection of the arguments of pro-slavery philosophers in the 1830s United States. And a lot of them, what we'd expect, you know, the biblical support and the scientific support. One of the articles was really getting to the point, which is, how would we have our comforts or elegancies without slavery? Which, of course, is the same thing today. But the one I want to really focus on for a second is there was this one Southern pro-slavery philosopher who was writing to a Northern abolitionist capitalist buddy and saying, you know, if we could arrange land ownership conditions like you have up north, we would give up our slaves in a second, because it's economically a much better idea to not own slaves, but it's all dependent upon land ownership conditions. And this is all going to have a point, which is that what he said is that if you have a lot of people, if you have a lot of land and not many people, that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means that the only way you can get them to work for you is the point of a gun. Which means that the way you get them to work for you is by making them chattel slaves. If, on the other hand, you have a lot of people and not much land, or if you can convince people that you own the land, little asterisk here, you know, people like to laugh at the so-called banana republics and say, you know, that the wealth disparity is really horrible in those countries and that just a few people own all the land. Well, I got news for them, which is the land ownership conditions in the United States are worse than in the so-called banana republics, by which I mean the land ownership is more concentrated in the United States. And these huge landowners are not even people for the most part. It's Sierra Pacific, it's Weyerhaeuser, it's big corporations, which don't even exist, actually. But anyway, back to the original point. If you can convince people that land ownership is tied up, or if you can convince people, or if you've got a lot of people on not much land, what that means, they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they are dependent upon you, which means that you can offer them whatever pittance you want, and they have to go to work for you, because otherwise they won't survive. So, you know, the listeners to this can look around and ask, you know, what happens if you don't pay rent? We're so metabolized into the system that we think that somehow it makes sense to pay somebody to actually exist on the planet. So we're talking about it being vulnerable. One of the things that the system can't stand is people who think and feel for themselves and who act upon that. There was a great line by a former head of South African security. It's a nice euphemism, isn't it? Former head of South African security during the apartheid regime. Afterwards, he said that, you know, the thing we were most afraid of from the ANC was not the sabotage or even the violence, as it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of South Africans to not have respect for law and order, because there is no security force in the world that can stand up to a population that does not respect law and order as such. And one of the reasons I want to mention all this in terms of vulnerability is that I just gave a talk a couple of days ago, and one of the things I asked the audience is, how many people here believe that we live in a democracy? Not a single person raised their hand. And I said, how many people believe that the government cares more for the rights of corporations or human beings? And everybody thought corporations. I mean, admittedly, that's a self-selected group because they were at one of my talks, but I used to teach at a conservative school, and I used to ask my students there at Eastern Washington University, I used to ask my students, so do you believe we live in democracy? They would laugh at me. Of course not. Everybody knows we don't live in a democracy. And I would say, do you believe that the government cares more for the rights of individuals or corporations? And they would laugh again. It's a stupid question. Everybody knows that the government is by and for the corporations. So we're one step of the way toward that recognition that the South African head of security was seeing, that we recognize that the government is not legitimate. I mean, somebody at some point, I can't remember who, was talking about something about taxation without representation. And I don't remember what they were saying that you should do when you are taxed but not represented. I think it was somebody named George. And then also there was this guy named Tom, and he was saying something about how if you have a government that is destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that it's the right, I believe, of the people to alter or abolish it. And when you have an entire economic system that is destroying life on the planet, I think that pretty much by definition, it is destructive of life. And I think if it's destroying the planet, by definition, once again, it's destructive of the pursuit of happiness. And so far as liberty, well, do you want to talk about the one-third of all African-American males in this country who are under so-called criminal justice supervision? Or maybe we should also cut to the chase and talk about this one guy in 1940, I think, or so. He was a senator or representative, I don't remember which, who was saying sarcastically, maybe we should just pass a law making it so nobody worth more than $1 million can ever be prosecuted for a crime. You know, of course, we all know that that's how the whole just us is, how some of my friends say, how the whole judicial system works, is that there is one system for the rich and one system for the poor. And of course, there's also one system for the whites and one system for the people of color, etc. I want to say one more thing about that, which is, I know we're really rambling, but you asked me to be on here. that I got this note from a cop after he read my book Endgame, and he said he really liked the book, and there was a lot that he really there were a lot I agreed with, and but one thing he didn't like is that he felt I was sort of scapegoating cops. He said, you know, cops aren't the real problem. I didn't really attack cops all that much in the book, but anyway, he said, you know, cops aren't really the problem, that cops are just doing their job. And of course, we can say the same thing about lots of others historically, and at the Nuremberg trials, it was specifically established that doing your job is not a good enough excuse, but leave that aside. They're just doing their job, and also one of the things they're doing is they're protecting people from sociopaths. And I agree. I mean, cops provide a very important role. You know, my mom's house got burgled, and call the cops. I mean, that's all fine. That's great. I got no problem with that. But one of the things I said to him, or I wrote back to him, and I said, you know, it's great, but if we're going to have any dialogue, I got to ask you a question, which is, why is it that when the police, or I'm sorry, why is it that whenever there's a strike, the cops always come in to force the strikers to terms? They never come in to force the capitalists to terms. And that makes me think one more thing, which is that I was doing a benefit for this community down outside of Las Cruces maybe a year or two ago, and I guess a couple years, and the community is trying to stop a toxic waste site from being put, a toxic waste dump being put in their community, in their poor community and people of color. And they were pointing out that the cops were not supporting the local community. The cops are supporting the distant corporation. And so we all started talking about how, what would it be like if cops started to enforce cancer-free zones, or if they were enforcing dam-free zones, or they're enforcing pro-salmon zones, or they're, what if cops were enforcing free speech? Of course, none of that can ever happen. So we were talking about, okay, if the official cops aren't going to do it, what if we in our communities, we decided to take responsibility and to, we in our community are going to enforce that we will not allow carcinogens to be manufactured in our community? What would happen if we in our community said, we are going to enforce free speech, that free speech will be allowed? And what if we're going to enforce that we in our communities are going to have rape-free zones? And what if we in our communities are going to have, you know, we can just go all down the list. And what, of course, that would look like is revolution.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio as we discuss the problem of civilization and building a culture of resistance with author and activist Derek Jensen. So what is it about this culture in this country and specifically that prevents that from happening?
Well, we might lose our access to ice cream 24/7. There's a character in a novel I have coming out next spring who, one of the best lines he has is, fear is the belief that you have something left to lose. We are afraid, and we have been bought off. Lewis Mumford wrote, and a lot of other people have written this, but Lewis Mumford, and I'm totally butcher this, so I shouldn't even brought him up because he would be spinning in his grave if he heard how badly I'm going to quote this. But basically, tyrants long ago learned that overt authoritarianism only goes so far, and it's not a very efficient way to run a system. A much more efficient way to switch from Mumford to Juvenal is through bread and circuses, to buy people off. Right now, we are all being bought off, which is bad enough when you consider simply oppression. And, you know, we're being bought off on our silence about the atrocities in Iraq, our silence about the atrocities in Palestine, our silence about atrocities in, you know, the United States. We're being bought off on that. That's bad enough. But at this point, we're talking about life on the planet. And we are being bought off with computer games, television, access to ice cream 24/7, like I said, and a very false sense of security. We are standing by watching the end of the world, you know, eating our ice cream. I like ice cream, but I don't like it better than a living world.
In your book, Endgame, and also in A Language Older Than Words, you talk about the death urge, what you call the death urge of this culture. Can you explain that?
Well, none of the stuff we're talking about makes any sense. The world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized for a greater value than the catch itself. That makes no sense. We'd all be better off if all the world's commercial fishermen were paid to stay home and sit in their underwear and watch The Price is Right. You know, we'd all be better off with that. And the fish would certainly be better off. Even from, you know, a purely economic perspective, none of this stuff is making sense. I mean, before we turned this on, we were talking a little bit about the honeybees and how, you know, people at this point know about the collapse of honeybee populations, and one of the strong suspects is a certain pesticide made by Bayer, and there is evidently a study, this is just an article today in the San Francisco Chronicle, that there is an article that there's a study done by the federal government and people are having to sue to get access to the study. Now, even if we presume that those in power don't care about honeybees, they don't care about life in general, which I think is a fairly safe assumption, you would presume that they would care about about the industrial agriculture system, and it makes no sense. And of course, honeybees are central to the entire industrial agricultural system, so you would think that they would want to maintain them. Okay, so that doesn't make sense. Or, I mean, what's the use of retiring rich on a dying planet? You know, once again, I mean, I have this new slogan, which is protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. Because without a land base, you don't have anything. So, once again, this isn't even exploiting others. This makes no sense. None of this makes any sense. So it's really clear to me that, I mean, I'll wake up and, you know, there'll be like just a few moments between waking and sleeping or sleeping and waking that I can't really believe that everything I write about is true, that this culture really is, that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, that global warming is melting the Arctic, and the response, the sort of mainstream response, is to get excited about who gets to drill in the Arctic, or, you know, the methane burps have started, and when the methane burps start, it's all over. This planet could turn into Venus. And the response in the articles that I've read about this has been that this burping methane could be a source of energy.
And talk about what that is. Maybe some people don't know what you're talking about.
There are inconceivable amounts of methane, which is, I believe, is 60 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. There are inconceivable amounts of methane, both frozen in tundra and also at the bottom of the ocean. And the concern is that as the tundra melts, it will release methane. And it already is doing that in some parts in Siberia where it's shooting up like geysers. And the other fear is that the methane that's frozen at the bottom of the ocean, that if it's warmed up enough, that it will bubble up to the surface and enter the air. And that could, once again, turn the planet into Venus. We're not just talking about Delta smelt, and we're not just talking about spotted owls and coho salmon and Kootenai sturgeon. We're talking about the big one. And the response, once again, even in the very same articles where they will mention the danger of this, is to talk about this could be a great new source of energy. Show me where that makes sense. We all know, we all recognize this culture is not, it needs to end, and it will end. I mean, it's in the Bible, you know, it's everywhere. It's beginning, middle, end. This culture is not cyclical. We all know that this culture will end, and we know that this culture is really wretched. And it doesn't matter. You know, we can choose whatever statistics we want, whether it's the gold standard study is that 25% of all women in this culture raped in their lifetime, another 19% for enough rape attempts, and all the women I know say those figures are very low, and the figures are actually far, far higher, approaching unity. And that's just actual legal definition of rape. That's not even including routine sexual harassment, anything like that. And, you know, it's on that level, or the level of wage slavery, or the level of fractured communities, any of these levels. And we all know that this way of life has to end, and nobody understands that this end could have been at one point metaphorical and spiritual, and so it's enacted in physical reality. And another part of the problem is that this culture inculcates us so much into being so afraid. I mean, really the central thesis of my book, A Language Older Than Words, we have an entire culture that's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because it's so traumatic, from everything from our gender relations to going to school to this, like I said, the wage slavery. Everything within this culture is really traumatic, and it's not the way we're supposed to live. Asterisk. I want to go a different direction for a second. We are right now doing this interview on Talawa land, and the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science, and if you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived just since the beginning of time, and they didn't trash the place. Once again, they lived here for 12,500 years. That's, but if we say 20 years a generation, let's see, my math's going to be very bad. That's, let's see, 60 generations would be 1,200 years. That's 600 generations at 20 years. Okay, so that's at least 600 generations. That's a long time. And when the first Europeans arrived here, it was an absolute paradise with, like I said, salmon in runs so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water. It was so thick that you couldn't see the bottom of the river. And this culture's been here for 180 years, and the place is trashed. I mean, everything about this culture is really traumatic. Judith Herman wrote this great book called Trauma and Recovery. And in that book, she talks about PTSD. And she also talks about complex PTSD. Not PTSD is if what happens if you're traumatized once. If you're, say, you're raped in a certain car, then whenever you see that make and model of car again, you might feel really anxious. And that's regular PTSD. But she said, what happens if you're actually in captivity? what she calls complex PTSD, which can include domestic violence, can include political prisoners, can include regular prisoners. One of the things that happens if you are traumatized repeatedly over time, especially in childhood, especially from the beginning, you can come to believe that mutually beneficial relationships are not possible, that all relationships are based on power and hierarchy. You can come to believe that, well, I mean, that's one of the central ones. And what is our political economy based on? What is sort of the dominant scientific perspective? What is the dominant scientific perspective on natural selection? Which is all crap, by the way. I mean, I'm not saying natural selection doesn't occur. What I'm saying is that the notion of survival of the fittest is crap. And I can show it in one sentence, which is those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. It's like Dolores LaChapelle taught me that it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the fit, how well you fit into your surroundings. And so this notion that all of life is based on this hierarchy is, I believe, based on a perception of, based on being deeply traumatized. And my point of bringing all this up having to do with the death urge is that one of the things that happens if you've been severely traumatized is that life is very scary. And what's the best way to not be scared in a scary situation is to try to control your surroundings. I know that that's true for me, that when I'm feeling traumatized, and especially around issues that I do have PTSD on, I need to control things around me, because otherwise it's very, very, very scary. That's one of the reasons why members of this culture have had to kill every indigenous culture, because they're not controllable. That's why they have to kill wild animals, because they're not controllable. There are other reasons, too. One of them also is that one of the reasons that the pilgrims had to kill off the Pequots is because there were so many pilgrims who were defecting. That was at first made a crime punishable by torture and death. That didn't suffice. There were still people running off to join the Indians. And what's the best way? How are you going to get people to stay in your wretched economy? By destroying the alternatives. Another way to say this is that no wild food stocks can survive the logic of capitalism. Because why would I go to the store to buy some food if I can go outside my back door and catch a meal of salmon? So it cannot survive it. Because how else are they going to get you to go to work at a job you don't love? Once again, it's all the same thing that we're talking about here. And that's one of the reasons for the death urge. It's a very practical reason. How else are you going to get people to stay in your wretched system? It was commonly noted that prisoner exchanges between whites and Indians back in the 1770s, 1780s, that the Indians would run joyously back to their families, and the whites would have to be bound hand and foot to not run back to their Indian captors, which was very, very embarrassing. But now, going back to something else we were talking about earlier, that why don't people revolt? Because they've been convinced that this is the only way to be. This is the real world. This is the one system. I mean, this culture has been really, it's really monotheistic in that it can brook no heresy and can allow no alternatives. Because if the alternatives were allowed to be realized, then who would stay here? Who would work jobs they don't love? And that's, by the way, also I just want to mention, standard anthropology that, you know, life among the indigenous was not nasty, brutish, and short. Life was much more full of leisure, and people lived in communities, and there were, I mean, we can talk about this on so many different levels, but in any case, well, and they are also sustainable. They lived there, they lived in place. And who was down in the Bay Area? The Pomo? And how long did they live there? 12,000 years probably, 10,000 at least. And I've read about what it was like when the first whites arrived there. And same deal, this is an absolute paradise. And, you know, it's gone. I mean, people used to drink from rivers, if you can imagine that. And the USGS, this is many years ago, the USGS came out and said that every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Which shouldn't surprise us, since every mother's breast milk in the world is contaminated with carcinogens. You know, how close does it have to get before we'll resist, before we'll fight back? I mean, we'll fight for our lives. At what point? I mean, how bad does it have to get?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio as we discuss the problem of civilization and building a culture of resistance with author and activist Derek Jensen. Jensen is the author of A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, How Shall I Live My Life, Endgame, and many other books and recorded CDs that tackle environmentalism, the prison industrial complex, education, and resistance. We continue our conversation with Derek Jensen as I asked him to explain one of the premises in his book, Endgame. Jensen writes that, quote, civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it is fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable, and when it does occur, it is regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims, end quote. I asked him to talk about this premise as it pertains to a reversal of our collective thinking that he says is essential to challenge and eventually overthrow this destructive cultural system.
We can see this everywhere. My own family. My father's extremely violent, and my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy. So that's one example. Another example is cops. That every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encounter police. That's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. Yet every time a cop dies, there's this big state funeral. Bumper sticker, some gave all gave some. You know what the most dangerous civil service profession is? Garbage collection. It's way, way more dangerous because they're hanging out with these big trucks, you know, that they get run over. But when was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector? Or when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where this intrepid garbage man is cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? You know, that ain't going to happen because it's not valorized, not violence flows down the hierarchy. It's another example. I live in bear territory, and I walk through the forest late at night, and people say, oh my gosh, aren't you afraid bears are going to attack you? Well, what I know is that there's one person dies in North America every 2 years because of bear attacks. And on the other hand, there are 42 or 44,000 people die in the United States every year from automobile accidents. So the truth is, we shouldn't be afraid walking through forests. Be afraid walking through a parking lot. You know, it's like all these big cars are going to get you. And what's another one? Jaws. You know, I live right near the ocean. I never get in the water. The reason? Because I saw that movie Jaws when I was like 15. And I can't. I go anywhere near the ocean. I start hearing that theme music. But the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. Another example, 9/11. When was the last time you heard a politician's speech that he didn't mention 9/11? You know, it's 9/10, frankly. What is it, about 3,000 people died there? Well, there's 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from the non-industrialized nations, the industrialized nations. But that doesn't count. There's 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks because of preventable cancers. Or if we go with the 4 to 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police, that means, what, 365, so let's say 350 days in a year, they'll take 2 weeks off. 350 days a year, let's call it four of them, is 1,400 a year, is 2,800 every 2 years. So about every 2.25 years, there's a 9/11 from cops. You know, but we don't hear any of those. Oh, it was so weird. A couple years ago, there was some cop shot a motorist, and so, of course, it was presented in the newspaper. It was going to be presented in the newspaper. The standard, you know, cop shoots motorist, so the motorist is down on the hierarchy, so it's got to be okay. But then the motorist was actually a African-American, which means they're even lower on the hierarchy, so it's really okay, except the person who got shot was an Iraqi war veteran. So, beep. Back up the hierarchy. So then it was really sort of odd to watch the newspaper. They didn't know what to do, because in a normal shooting like that, it's like obviously the person's fault because they were having an epileptic seizure, for crying out loud. But in this case, the newspaper was falling all over themselves because it didn't follow the standard plot. So the point is, we see this all over, where it is acceptable for those in power to shoot the violence down, but if anybody even thinks about shooting the violence back up, that's absolutely unthinkable. It's blasphemy. I mean that in the most religious sense, in terms of it being absolutely unthinkable. I mean, I remember this a few years ago. It was probably 10 years ago now, where there were some cops who were beating up some guards in California Youth Authority who were actually caught on tape, on videotape, beating up the prisoners. And they were found not guilty, of course, because it was premise for an action. Or we can look at the prison sentences given to men who beat their wives to death versus the women who killed the men who were attempting to beat them to death. I don't remember the numbers on that. I think the average is like 7 years for the men and 20 years for the women or something. I'm making those numbers up, but it is disproportionate like that. Oh, a great example, actually, is a few years ago, there's a guy in Oklahoma who beat his wife to death. And for that, he was sentenced, I think, to 7 years in prison. But as he was going through the judicial process, he spat on a cop. And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison, which, you know, that's everything you need to know about premise four right there. But we can throw out another one. Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney has killed far more people than Charles Manson ever did. And in fact, we don't even need to go to a place of Charles Manson killing people directly, because he didn't. He didn't actually do the killing. I'm not saying that the guy shouldn't be put away. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they both basically ordered killings. And Dick Cheney's highly rewarded, and Charles Manson's in prison for the rest of his life.
Well, Dick Cheney also shot somebody in the face.
The face, that's right. Yeah. Charles Manson never even did that.
Derek Jensen, you talk a little bit about the threshold. Like, what's it going to take? So fine, we have this information. We are outraged beyond repair. We are watching our planet being killed. And even those of us who are on, you know, the left and or the so-called progressive wing, we feel a sense of urgency. Yet we still organize protests that are sanctioned by the state. We get permits to protest on a Saturday. We tell each other not to antagonize the enemy, or else we'll become just like them.
Enemy? What enemy? You can't talk about an enemy. That's divisive. That's dualistic. I think I need to end this interview now. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, what's the threshold?
I think for most people there isn't one. It's very interesting. In Nazi Germany, when members of the middle class would be put into concentration camps, oftentimes they were, even after they themselves were put into the prison camps or concentration camps, they refused to acknowledge that the entire system was unjust. And they would whine that in their particular case, a mistake had been made. But they remained identified with the system. And they would grovel to the guards. And they would do anything they could. And they were routinely snitches, and which didn't gain them any benefits, by the way. The Gestapo and the prison guards would love the snitching and hate the snitcher. So the point is that even when they themselves were suffering directly, they refused to question the system. And I think the first thing we need to do is to recognize that the system is not benefiting life on the planet. The system is systematically exploitative. It promises pie in the sky when we die. But in the meantime, the gap between rich and poor grows wider, and the planet gets murdered. And I think we also need to recognize that ultimately, those in power are not going to, they're not going to give up without a fight, which means that any form of resistance, in quotes, that they sanction is going to be ultimately ineffective, because they will not allow any form that's effective. And if you begin to do something really effective, as in Black Panthers delivering breakfast, it doesn't matter whether it's violent or nonviolent. If it's effective, they will shut it down. The point is not, we can talk about violence and nonviolence, but the point is not violence and nonviolence. The point is effectiveness and ineffectiveness. And if you do something effective, they will stop you. They will. Because they are not going to allow any reduction in their power. Part of the problem is that, you know, the candlelight vigils and all that stuff, I mean, that's all fine if you want to feel good, but actually, I don't care about purity. I don't care about feeling good. What I care about is living in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and I'll do whatever it takes to get there. And part of the problem with our resistance is that it is ultimately very infantile, in that a lot of it's based on magical thinking. If we hold a protest, then things are going to magically change. If we light candles, things are going to change. But it's like Ward Churchill says, you know, if you can write the song that is going to change everything, I'll sing it. You know, if you can find a candle that's going to change something, I'll light it and I'll hold it. I'll hold two of them. But we all know that holding a candle is not going to do anything. And we can see this when it's applied somewhere else. If you're a member of the Russian resistance in World War II, is holding a candle, is this what you're going to do? Is you're going to hold a candle? Or maybe you're going to not buy anything from IG Farben? What are you going to do to stop the Nazis? That's the question. What are you going to do to stop the Nazis? And if you think my comparison is not apt, then think about it from the perspective of the indigenous. Think about it from the perspective of the hammerhead sharks. Think about it from the perspective of coral reefs. There is a mass holocaust going on. There is the greatest holocaust that has ever happened that absolutely dwarfs the Capital H holocaust. This is the end point of this culture. And I think that holding a candle or signing a petition is an absolutely pathetic response to the mass injustices we see. What we need to do is to stop them using whatever means are necessary, because they must be stopped. And Frederick Douglass was the one who said that power exceeds nothing without demand. And there's another part of it, too, is you know, a lot of our resistance is based on magical thinking, but another part of it is pretty much infantile also, because it's based on the idea, it's based on asking, on petitioning, on begging those in power to act differently than we know they will. That's all we do. That's the best that we do, is beg. We never demand. Oh, yeah, okay, we're going to demand. What demand means that you're going to back it up with something. So we, you know, you need to stop committing these atrocities, or we're going to write you a really sharply worded note. We're going to hold two candles and sing a song. It's like that's not scary. We don't demand, and we don't do it ourselves. We don't, you know, if we want dams removed because dams are killing salmon, what we do is we beg those in power to take them out. We don't demand they take them out, and we don't simply do it ourselves. And that's not good enough. I love the word responsibility, because it means to give in return. And what is it that we owe this planet for giving us life? We owe it our lives back. And I don't know why more people don't resist. You know, that same talk I did a couple days ago, I asked people, how many have had someone you love die of cancer? About 80% said yes. It's killing those we love directly. I have Crohn's disease, which is an incurable progressive disease caused by civilization. And civilization is literally eating away at my guts. And other people, diabetes, you know, we can go down the list. I have a friend who has a shirt that says, my father dropped Agent Orange on Vietnam and all I got was this lousy leukemia. You know, it doesn't matter how close it gets. A lot of times people will say, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've written essays for magazines where, you know, I'll write about the apocalypse and then they'll say, make sure that you end on a hopeful note. And one of the things I say at all my talks is that hope is really harmful for a couple of reasons. One is because I think false hopes are incredibly, incredibly harmful. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. So do you want to get an ID card, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto? Or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get in a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist, because of these false hopes. So one of the things I think that we absolutely must do is eradicate false hope, absolutely ruthlessly. The good news about all that is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. I think we all need to keep that in mind over the next 10 years. But the problem isn't just false hope, but it's hope itself. Because I was doing a talk several years ago in Colorado, and I'm bashing hope, and someone in the audience shouts out, what's your definition of hope? So I don't know, I've been bashing for years, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And I asked the audience what their definition is, and the people in the audience were able to come up with a really good definition, which is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And that's how we use it in everyday language. You know, I don't hope that I eat something tomorrow. I'm just going to do it. On the other hand, the next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash, because once it's in the air, I got no agency. Yet we all say, I hope that salmon survive, or I hope that Israel stops putting in new colonies, or, you know, I hope that the U.S. stops invading countries. I hope that this culture doesn't kill the planet. What you're doing is you're acknowledging that you have no agency. And this is, it's just absurd. I mean, how old's your kid?
Almost 8.
Okay, so if you asked your child to clean her room and she said to you, I hope it gets done, your response is?
You will clean your room now.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. I mean, it's a non-starter.
Yeah.
Yet when it comes to these larger issues, we suddenly get really stupid and start saying, oh, gotta have hope, gotta have hope. Well, screw hope. I'm not interested in hope. What I'm interested in is action. What I'm interested in is action. We have a number of advantages that Tecumseh didn't have. One of them is that the indigenous, even though they had functioning communities, they had warrior societies, they had, you know, people with long histories of working communally, you know, how do we know who to trust now? But they didn't have that problem. They didn't have any of that. But we have some advantages. One of them is that they had no way of conceptualizing how horrible this culture is. They had no way to make context for that. We don't have that excuse. We who know about the Inquisition, we who know about the Great Ox, we who know about long history of torture, we who know about slavery, we who know about wage slavery, we who know about misogyny, we who know about, once again, that this culture is killing off the salmon, that's killing off the oceans. All we have to do is pay attention to see how insatiable this culture is, that it will not stop on its own. We have that advantage. Another advantage we have is that had Tecumseh tried to walk into a city, he would have been recognized and killed immediately. But we're already in all those cities. We're in Memphis, Tennessee, and San Francisco, California, Seattle, Washington, and we're in Mexico City, and we're in Tokyo. We're already there. And increasingly, there are people who recognize that the system will not change on its own, and who recognize that those in power will scruple at nothing to increase their power. You know, what are those in power going to do if we make them really mad? Are they going to kill the world twice? Increasingly, there are people who recognize that it is long past time that we begin to make effective resistance against this culture. And increasingly, there are people who are utterly disillusioned. And I mean that in the sense of having lost their illusions about the feasibility of working solely within the system. And I think it's very important. I'm not one of those people who believes in the revolution versus reform dichotomy. Because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, nobody does anything in the meantime, there's not going to be anything left. But increasingly, there are people who recognize that if all we do is reform work, the system's going to grind away until there is nothing left to. So increasingly, there are people who recognize that this system cannot and will not last. And increasingly, there are people who are willing to fight with and for their lives and the lives of those they love. And increasingly, there are people who, to take us back to near the beginning, increasingly, there are people who recognize that the system is incredibly vulnerable. Black blood of the economic system. And who are willing to do whatever it takes to make sure that the dominant culture doesn't destroy the world that's their only home.
That was the voice of award-winning author and environmental philosopher Derek Jensen, author of many books, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and Endgame. Jensen has a website, www.derekjensen.org, where you can go to find out more information about his work and various appearances across the country. Coming up in October, Jensen will be leading a workshop in Lincoln City, Oregon, October 24th to 26th, with Eric McBay and Lier Keith. Entitled Deep Green Resistance, Jensen will be exploring the question, if we really accept the seriousness of the situation, what would that mean for our strategy and tactics? Registration ends September 23rd, and all the information is available again on Jensen's website, www.derekjensen.org. That's Deep Green Resistance, taking place in Lincoln City, Oregon, October 24th to 26th. Stay tuned to Flashpoints for part two of this conversation with Derek Jensen, independent journalist Dar Jamail, and me, Nora Barrows Friedman. Thanks for listening.
If you got the nerve, lash out for your
just desserts. It's not just the words. Some of y'all heads up in the cloud. I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black back to burn. Boom, y'all talking about out your mouth. I'm not concerned, cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turned like Detroit Red when his head had an ultra perm. The long walk I burn. Your bare heels soaked the worn your boots. The game camouflage like army suit. But I can see it more clear cause I came with the coupe in here. Ring the alarm, inform the truth. Send them out into the world, go to war on the flu. Out of eye with the enemy you sworn to shoot. Now I'm coming at your neck, sick of hearing something wrong with me. Something wrong with you. When the cheap just way too smart to question. The enemy, the brothers of a dark complexion. The governments of the world is shark infested. They heavy on weaponry like Sharpton Heston, man. Look, it gets low here. Get it. To the pigs is my basic statement. I spit street stories till I taste the pavement. Trying to stay out the pen where we face enslavement. Had a foolproof puzzle till they traced the payments. I was gripping my palm around something wrong. Trying to find Psalm number 151. Forget what I'm old as I clutch the commodore. Put down the bottle and come get the gun. Let's get off the chain like Kunta Kinte with a Mac-10. They want us gone like a dollar in a crack den. Subtly subtracting seeds and stems. Mind cloudy through the weeds and phlegm. Numbing my brain off of that and the Jesus hymns. If we waiting for the time to fight these is them. Telling us to relax while they ease it in. We getting greased again. The truth I write is so cold it'll freeze my pen. A boots rider, it's a pleasure to meet you. Never let they punk ever defeat you. They got us on the corner wearing pleather and see-through. All y'all's gold mines, they wanna deplete you. I ain't just finna rap on the track, I'm finna clap on the back. And it's been sacking of that. 500 years before Iceberg ever leaned back in the lack. Before they told Rosa Black in the back. Before the CIA told Ricky Ross to put crack in the sack. The Gills got traded rapping for smack. This beat alone should get platinum plaque. I'd rather see a million of us ecstatic to scrap. Cause if we rapping them back, we automatically stack. Check it out.
Like showing C, reboots me, activating the community. Up in the bay like Huey P. They suck a free and remind me of the BK is loving me. But the beast gotta twist it, I'll untangle it. Black mind is twine like the ropes I used to hang it with. This my favorite. I came in the game with a new way to spit. Got your questionnaire, who you banging with? Take it back to M Hotep. Go a step deeper like a poor. I just teach you a holy intellect. Kill a flow for a real left and for the failure. It's been a death.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, our technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our weekly Best of Flashpoints program producer is Amanda Bellerby. To comment on today's program, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
September 19th, KPFA presents 1968, a discussion on the lessons and vibrant legacy of the year that shook the world, featuring preeminent left intellectual Manuel Wallerstein, Mexican writer Paco Ignacio Taibo, Angola 3 political prisoner Robert Hillary King, labor historian Staunton Lind, Balkan radical Andrei Gribacek, and feminist historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. The panel will take place at the Julia Morgan Theater, 2640 College Avenue in Berkeley, at 7 p.m. on Friday, September 19th. wheelchair access, and tickets sold at the door. For more information about this or other 68 events taking place in September, go to KPFA's website, insurrection68.org.
94.1 KPFA Berkeley, 89.